Good morning, everyone. Greet you in Jesus' name this morning. This morning's message, I'll give you the title, then I'll explain why we're here this morning. The title this morning is Principles for Godly Courtship. And I confess that it feels a little strange to talk about this because it seems like it's something everybody should probably know about. But I thought this would be a particularly appropriate time to talk about it since there's nobody apparently dating in our congregation at this point. And I say apparently because the new fad is to have secret dates, I guess. But anyway, I do think, though, that people of my age, we kind of just assume that all of you young people know what's expected of you. And maybe you don't. Maybe you do. And so I would like to just spend some time this morning talking about it. I don't think I'm going to be introducing anything new to anybody today. And actually, if you try to go through the Bible and find a good dating story, you're going to come up dry. There aren't any, unless I'm missing one. But if you think about the Bible stories of marriages, they're actually a lot more businesslike than the North American culture would like us to think. And when you think about some of the relationships between men and women, the ones that went the best, at least from the stories that we read, for instance, Adam and Eve, I guess that was a good relationship. They didn't really have much choice at all in the matter, did they? Adam just wakes up out of sleep, and here's this person that God says, here you go, this is your wife. What kind of love story is that? And you go forward a little bit, we don't even have any idea how Abraham and Sarah met. Isaac and Rebekah, that was kind of a strange story compared to our culture. And I would say theirs was fairly successful. Abraham and Sarah's, I guess, was. All of them, though, were a little bit turbulent here and there in spots. Esau, I don't know what his arrangements were, but he just went and got wives from groups that grieved his parents a lot. And Jacob, he goes, and Laban, of course, plays games with him and ends up with a woman that he didn't really want for his wife. And but when you read the stories of Jacob, Leah, Rachel, I don't know, would you say they were good marriages? I'm not trying to make it seem like these Bible characters are bad people. I'm just pointing out that the glamour of romance that we somehow wish existed doesn't really exist in real life. I'm going to be pretty blunt, I guess. I'm concerned that we don't overrate dating, but I'm also concerned that we don't turn it into a game of some kind. So in our culture, the purpose of dating, and I'm going to use the word dating, I know courting is probably a better term, but I don't know if I'm not old enough because it just feels weird on my tongue to say courtship. I'm not sure why it does, but it does. Now I realize that in the world's definition of dating, we would say we don't date, because that becomes more of a game of seduction and there's very little commitment involved in dating in the worldly practice. But in our sheltered culture, it basically, courtship and dating are used interchangeably. And we would say that the point of it is that we are visiting, spending time with one person specifically to see or to discover if the two of you wish to spend the rest of your lives together. And so I think we should do it seriously enough that we remember that the purpose of this is just that. Are we Are we going to find God's will leading us together, or is this not a good, this is not going to work? Well, turn with me to Genesis chapter 2. I want to just take you to that story there, because there's a principle. I would like to just look at some principles and then apply them to dating, courtship, relationships. And there's a principle that shows up in the New Testament that is quoted from Genesis chapter 2. When God makes the woman in verse 22, and then in verse 23, Adam says, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man." And I don't know if Adam continues to speak when he says verse 24, or if that's just commentary on the story that the author put in there, or if God is saying something. But verse 24, "Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh." And so we have this concept of a man and a woman becoming one flesh. And Jesus picks that back up in Mark chapter 10. I'll just use that as that passage. It shows up in other passages. But in Mark chapter 10, whenever they were discussing divorce, Jesus affirms in verse 7 that male and female were created for the cause that a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall be one flesh. Okay, so that's marriage language. But like I said, you're not going to actually find modern-day dating in the Bible. It's just not there, unless I am totally missing a story. By the way, I did want to say this yet, back about the whole thing of the arrangements that people made in their lives. Another man that got his way when it came to women would have been Samson, and we know how that worked out. It wasn't good, but he insisted on something that God said no, and he got what he wanted, but it wasn't what he wanted. Anyway, but what I want to get from this principle about this particular, these verses that I read from Genesis and Mark. Sometimes people wonder how old you should be before you're old enough to date or consider getting married. And I think the rule of thumb is that you should not be dating or considering dating until you are considered a man and a woman. Because it doesn't say that boys leave their homes, but a man does. And so there's a period of time as we mature and grow that we are not capable of supporting the responsibility of a wife as young men. And as young ladies, you're not really capable of understanding what it takes to support a household and a husband. And so before that age is reached, there's really no point in trying to cultivate special friendships with somebody and act like you've got some romance going on, because you're just setting yourselves up for serious problems. So don't even bother. Don't create those attachments. It may be that you have this elementary school sweetheart that somehow you end up going and marrying later on in life. And I'm not saying that can never work. It might actually work well. But for us to promote that as the way that God leads us to our partner, I'm going to say is dangerous to assume. And as we get older and we become more interested in this idea of getting married, which is, by the way, very normal. I don't want anybody to think that we shouldn't feel the desire to get married. I would be alarmed if people didn't have the desire. So obviously, it's a very normal process. Not everybody gets married, of course, but it's normal to think about it. But the age of taking serious steps to cultivate a friendship with somebody, some parents have age limits, and you should honor that age limit. If your parents say that you will not get married before 21, then trying to start dating at 17 is a really bad idea. That's too long to be cultivating a special friendship with someone. lots of things can change between 17 and 18 and even 18 and 20. There's a lot of maturity that happens in those years, and it's good. And you don't need the distraction of a special friendship to get in the way of that maturing process. And so if, for instance, if your parents have that kind of rule of 21 or something like that, it's not a good idea to try to start very young. I think somewhere in our church directions, we recommend 18 as the youngest. And I know that varies a lot. It seemed like there for a while. In the history of the Mennonite church, there was lots of young couples, which is fine. And then it seemed like we went through a spell there around the time I got married. I was one of the youngest in my age, my peer group, to get married. Some of the ones that I would have grown up with got married into their 20s, and it's all fine, really. It's not really anything wrong with that. I'm just saying that it kind of fluctuates. It goes back and forth, and I don't even know what all influences that. But anyway, I don't have an age to put down and say this is how old you must be, but I do think the Bible principle is that someone who is considered a man, and in our culture of North America, it means that you should be able to financially provide for a household and whatever that means, also spiritually and emotionally support someone. Well, that's that one principle. 1 Corinthians chapter 7 has some interesting principles for marriage. And it would be good probably just to talk about 1 Corinthians 7 sometime, the whole chapter. But I want us to focus on another principle. When we think about dating, we've established that we should be old enough to be considered men and women, not boys and girls. And we now want to discuss who should we think about when we think about getting married, or who's dating, who should we even consider. There's a principle of marriage in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 39. Now, the context is bigger. It talks about a wife and a husband and whether or not they're bound to each other and how long they're bound to each other. But Paul says, the wife is bound by the law as long as her husband lives. But if her husband is dead, she's at liberty to be married to whom she will. And then he adds this, only in the Lord. And so he's saying a woman who is a widow is allowed to remarry. And we understand that's okay. It's nothing wrong with that. And he says she can marry whoever she wants to. Only in the Lord. So he puts that in there. And there's a lot of discussion that could be had about this. But I think this phrase is a principle that teaches us that when we think about something as serious as marriage, when we're actually thinking about covenanting, vowing to spend time with someone the rest of your life, you're going to become one flesh, as it were, in marriage. It limits it. A Christian should only consider marrying a Christian. It is a really bad idea to try to use marriage as a way to convert somebody else. Now, I know that in Peter, he does say that if an unbelieving husband is pleased to dwell with his believing wife, that's okay. It's an okay arrangement to have that happen. But it seems like the implication of that is if for some reason the woman gets converted to Christianity and the man just doesn't. Peter makes the case that it's good for them to stay together. And possibly because the woman's relationship with Christ makes her a new person, that might actually be a means of converting a husband. But for a young person at 19 or 20 years old to assume that he can go and marry an ungodly woman, or a young lady can marry an ungodly man in the hopes that that will convert that person, I don't know what the statistics are on that. But I would hazard the guess that it's a pretty low percentage that actually works. I think Peter might also be talking about people who apostatize. If you're married and one of your husband or your wife departs from the faith, and even though that grieves us when that happens, that alone isn't grounds to separate. I think that's another thing that Peter is saying right there. But anyway, so for us today as Christian young people, you would be very wise to follow this biblical principle that you will only consider other Christians. Beyond that, who should you consider dating? Well, as young men, being the ones responsible to initiate these friendships, we don't usually have much trouble at this point. We pretty much know the kind of young lady we're attracted to. And the only scary thing is we don't know if she might be interested in us, and so that makes the whole thing really scary. But for the young lady, you're in a totally different position because you have no idea if the young man that you think is the greatest is actually going to be motivated to seek your friendship. And so I would just say to you young ladies this morning, it is not a good idea to try to show whatever young man you're interested in that you would really like if he would pursue you. Don't do that, even if you do think there's somebody you think would be the greatest husband in the world. Resist the temptation to try to telegraph to him that you would really be interested in starting a friendship. Thinking it's a good way to make yourself look like a fool, for one thing, and also to set yourself up for dreams that could make you pretty miserable if they never work out. So just remember to trust God with that situation. And I believe that two Christians who want God's will find each other, and God will bring the person into your life that is the best for you if you're truly seeking his will. So what kind of person should you look for? Who should you look for? Well, I think a Christian person who has proven that they know what it's like to be a Christian. And so I think there should be a little bit of maturity involved in the Christian life as well as just normal life. Does this person, this young man, this young lady, does he or she know what it's like to actually stay faithful in difficult situations? Do they prove that they're going to be with Christ, or are they just wishy-washy and anytime something hard comes along, they're tempted to bail out and, you know, if this is the way Christian life is, I'm not sure I want to be a Christian. You know, that kind of person isn't really this kind of person. I think James would call him or her double-minded. Not sure where the loyalties are going to be. And so you want someone who's proven to a certain extent. Obviously, at the ripe old age of 19, life's experience are pretty limited. You're not going to have a lot of proof that he can or she can withstand a lot of pressure. And yet, there would be signs. There's going to be indications by that time whether a person knows what it is to live in Christian victory. There's an old saying, it's not in the Bible, but I think it should be in the Bible, and that is the old saying that birds of a feather flock together. There's a similar idea, though, in Proverbs 13. This is a principle that's true for all friendships, but it's also true for people thinking about dating. It's in Proverbs 13, verse 20. He that walketh with wise men shall be wise, but a companion of fools shall be destroyed. Now, that doesn't say exactly what I just quoted, the old saying of birds of a feather, but what both of them do is it shows us that the people that we are attracted to and the people that we are around are the people that we are and the people that we will become. So if you want to be a victorious and steady Christian young man or young lady, you're going to have to spend time with steady, victorious Christian old men and old ladies. That's who your role models are going to be. They might look a little boring sometimes, but if you are brave enough to actually spend time with them, you will become like them. If you want to be wise, you walk with wise men. If you want to be foolish, then you can be, but Proverbs says you're going to be destroyed. And so it's never a good idea to have your counsel come from people of your same age. There's a story about Rehoboam. He did that, didn't he? Complete disaster. The old men said, if you're going to be wise, you're going to do something different than your dad. And the young men said, oh, why would you try to be nice to these poor people? Just work them harder, tax them more. And it didn't work out well. Seeking advice from younger people about who to marry is a little bit like Rehoboam asking his friends what kind of king he should be. And it's just the way it is. You may be, as a young person, you may be smarter than your parents in many, many ways. And I've said this to y'all before, and I'm going to just say it again. But the annoying thing about older people is that they will always have more experience than you. And that's annoying as a young person because you think you should be able to trump them somehow, but you can't. You just cannot ever live longer than an older person, as long as they're alive. So anyway, back to who should you consider dating. The point in all of this is that it is more important to focus on becoming the kind of person that you should be, the kind of Christian you should be, than trying to decide who the best husband or wife would be. Because once you become the kind of person that you should be in Jesus Christ, you will attract and be around the kind of people that are like you. That's just the principle of friendship. And I don't even know how that's supposed to work. I know sometimes parents are told that they're supposed to make sure their children have good friends, but the truth is I don't think I can pick my children's friends. All I can do is try to train my children to be the kind of people that they should be. I don't know what else to say about friendship, because I am sure that if my parents tried to say, you have to be friends with this person but not this person, that would have not worked very well. You're attracted to the people that have similar values. So anyway, once you're past these points, what are some principles that should guide the dating process? There's an Old Testament prophet by the name of Amos. In chapter 3, verse 3, he asks the question, can two walk together unless they be agreed? So one of the principles in dating is to find out what kind of agreement you can reach with a person. It is completely unreasonable and unnatural for two people raised in different homes, even if they go to the same school and the same church for years and years and years, to agree on everything. My wife and I have been married now 19 years, and we still don't agree on everything. It's not even healthy to agree on every single thing with someone that you're interested in getting married to, or even the people you go to church with. It's just not even a natural process of human experience. But when Amos asks the question, can two walk together except they be agreed, there are some foundational things that need to be agreed on. And the dating process is learning to know whether or not you can agree on certain fundamental things. That's the whole point. Because if you're going to become one and live together in a decent relationship for the rest of your life, you're gonna want to know if these values are shared. And so I put two things down, and I don't know if these are the only two, but to me they're two big ones. The first one is, do you share spiritual goals and dedication to Jesus Christ? And there's a whole bunch of sub-points that could come under that. But if you do not both care deeply about having a relationship with Jesus and living your Christian life out, if one of you is just like, oh, well, it doesn't really matter that much, I'm going to do the bare minimum to stay a member of my church, and if that church ever gets too hard on me, I'm just going to skip over to the next church that lets me do a little bit more of what I want to do. If that's the kind of person you are, and you're friend is completely opposite, and he or she is like, no, I want to be dedicated to Jesus. I want to make my decisions based on the scripture and the collective conviction of my brotherhood, and I want to be someone that is useful in the kingdom of God, even in little ways, if there's that big of a difference between the two, I'm not sure how that's supposed to work in the long run. And so it comes down to lots of little decisions. And one of the things that I've learned as I've lived and watched and listened is that even something very simple under this point is, where are you going to go to church? Now, I suppose if you're going to plan to live in Mississippi right here, there's really only one conservative Mennonite church. But there's plenty of other churches you can go to. And if your desire is not to live a conservative Mennonite lifestyle in a conservative Mennonite church, and your friend can see no other good way to live, you need to work that out. You need to decide if it matters or not. Now, if you're in an area where there's lots of different stripes of flavors of Mennonite churches, even then, not all churches have the same feel or culture, and you have to know what you can do and what you can't do. And some of that's impossible to know, but you're going to have to at least talk about it. Another main point of agreement that needs to be at least discussed, I think, at some point, is the issue of your financial goals. I do not believe that you should have a certain amount of money in the bank before you can get married, but I do think you have to prove whether or not you can handle the little bit or the lot that you have. And obviously, anything can happen. So suppose you do agree on your spiritual goals and visions, and you do agree on the way to handle money. Once you get married, there's all kinds of things that can happen. Somebody might get super sick and take every penny you ever saved in medical expenses. That can happen. Men have lived through that. Women have lived through that. But my point is that we need to know that we care about the same things. Is the young lady that I'm considering as a wife someone that I can hand a credit card to and not worry that it's going to be maxed out in 2 weeks? That's something to think about. Some ladies really like to spend a lot of money. And of course, the flip side is true too. Can this young man actually handle money, or is he more interested in making sure that his truck looks right? Or will he take care of household things and that kind of thing? And you, again, you can know these things if you want to be objective about them. So that's one principle. There needs to be some agreement on those things. And there's a lot of other little things that probably need to be agreed on, but to me, those are the two big ones. There's always going to be differences. In fact, the weird thing about attraction between men and women is that we tend to end up being attracted to someone who's very different from us in at least one or two ways. And I think that's by God's design. It's to make us round it out a little bit better and see things from a perspective without becoming too stubborn or something like that. And so, obviously, you're not going to agree on everything. I'm just giving these as principles that matter, because over those two things, a lot of breakdown can happen. Anyway, second thing, in relationships, dating relationships, I think we should talk about headship a little bit. 1 Corinthians 11, verse 3, I would have you know, the head of every man is Christ, and the head of the woman is the man, and the head of Christ is God. Ephesians 5:23 repeats that. And both of those passages talk about relationships between men and women and Christ and how the church and all of that comes together. And so our culture does not... Well, let me back up. So for young men, if you want to think about dating, and one of the principles that needs to be worked on in your life is understanding headship. And it is not difficult to understand why the Bible tells us that we need to love and lead. It's because we don't do those things naturally. We want to do something else. We want to be served, and we want to just, you know, take advantage of every opportunity that we can to be lazy and selfish. And so in headship, obviously, if you're a young person living under your parents, this is a little bit of a murky subject, perhaps, because your dad is obviously the man of the house. But I think as young men, you can start practicing taking responsibility in areas that you're given responsibility. And so, for instance, when you're asked to have a devotions at church or something like that, you do it and you take it serious and you try to do the best that you can with that. In the family, it's taking responsibility for little people. If you have younger siblings, you can show that you care about them by actually helping them with things as a young man, or taking care of your mother in ways that she could use help. If your dad gives you responsibility, you take it seriously and you do it well to the best of your ability. And so in dating then, when you move into that relationship with a young lady, you take the lead in setting the standards for the courtship. Our American culture tells us that the mark of a man is to push a woman as far as she will let you, and then see if you can get away with what she'll let you get away with. That's what American culture says, you know, he's a man when he can seduce a woman, basically. That is completely false. That is ungodly, and it should not ever be the way we treat women. In that kind of environment, the women then take all the responsibility for the standard of behavior in that relationship. And God is calling us as men to be the ones. Just as Christ protects and loves his church, we protect and love the women that God has trusted us with. And we set the boundary. We learn what self-giving love is, and we take care of the leading, because then she knows that she can be safe with you. And that's something you can practice in your thoughts, in your actions, toward everybody, not just women, but toward everyone. You are the one who's not trying to take advantage of people in any way. And so for young women in the headship, the Bible commands you all that you should reverence and submit. And these are hard words for a man to talk about, but it's just the way it is. And it's because it's easy for women to think that they should be in control, especially if the man is being slow and stubborn about something. And you can practice this while living under your father's headship. There's two areas probably that you could focus on as young ladies. 1 Peter 3, if I can turn there. Peter talks about women. He uses expressions like chaste conversation and the inward, the hidden man of the heart, not adorning the outward person with all kinds of decorations, but rather to have the hidden, meek and quiet spirit. And then over in 1 Timothy 2:9, Paul, in a very similar way, he talks about this thing of shamefacedness. And I'm just going to tell you a story just to illustrate what I think shamefacedness means. I remember being in a place one time where there was a young lady, not a Mennonite lady. In fact, if I had to guess, I would say she was Holiness or Pentecostal or something like that. But I guess I'll just say what across my mind. She had no outward adornment. And at the time, one of the things I was noticing that seemed to be a trend among our young ladies is an obsession with eyebrows and trying to pluck eyebrows to the right shape and that kind of thing. But this young lady, in a bank, as a Pentecostal, evidently never messed with her eyebrows. I think that's pretty much one of the things that means, that's what shamefacedness means. It doesn't mean that you walk around looking ashamed or that you never talk. That's not what it means. But it does mean that you understand that the value of a godly character has a beauty that will outlast all the fake beauty that is designed really only to make men push boundaries. That's just what the world does. And so you understand that. Another thing about a meek and quiet spirit is that you understand that it is not your responsibility to correct things that seem to be wrong. There are things that you have responsibility to correct if it's in your life or in your immediate care. For instance, if you're a school teacher and you're responsible to take care of the schoolroom. But when you get older and there's things that happen, maybe there's some trouble in the relationships at church or something like that, one of the worst things women can do in those situations is try to control those situations and make things happen that they think should happen. And a meek and quiet spirit understands that they are not responsible, that they are going to show God's love and God's character to everyone. Anyway, that's some ways you can practice that. And so you can practice this at home. You don't have to be in control of everything at home. You don't have to be the one with the last word. You can learn what it is to act and behave in a way that Paul calls shamefaced and Peter says is meek and quiet. And it shows up in the way you act, what you say, and of course, what you wear. So that's the second principle in headship. Third principle that guides our courtships is purity. I'll try to be as discreet as I can on this point, but we all know that the Bible forbids fornication. We understand that. This is clear. We could look through passages to prove that the Bible says that that's out. We're not going to do that. But I would like to just make a case for keeping our courtships hands off. I suspect that, again, people my age, we heard it preached a lot, and it's unfortunate whenever you realize that there are young people that claim they have never heard it preached over the pulpit, which is one of the reasons that I thought I should. Because it does seem like sometimes we preachers think that since we heard it, everybody from now till the day I die is going to hear it too, which is really foolish, because if nobody actually ever says it, then nobody's going to hear it. But anyway, I don't know that I can turn to any Bible verses that would indicate what kind of physical relationship is okay in a dating relationship, because the Bible doesn't talk about dating the way we do it. There is a verse in Romans, though, that tells us that we should make no provision for the flesh. And so any action that allows us to toy with or indulge in the flesh, and this is not just in dating, this is true for everybody that wants to be a Christian. We have to understand that when we start making provision for the flesh in any area, whether it's just sleeping too much in the morning or whatever it is, that we when we feed the flesh, it's going to grow. And so Romans says don't give it food, don't make provision for it. And so we take the provisions away so that we can live in the Spirit of God. Anyway, so why should we be hands-off? I'm just going to give you four reasons that I think we should be hands-off. Maybe it's three reasons and then a question. So the relationship of dating is a strange relationship. I told you that I think it should be serious. It should be one where you're trying to find out if you're compatible for marriage, if that's what you want to do. But when you're dating, you are not in a covenant relationship. That's not yet where you are. And so the relationship as a dating couple could end at any time for a number of different reasons. And so if we're going to be considerate of the person that we're courting or dating, and if we want to release them from that friendship for whatever reason, then we would like to, as Christians, they should be released from that relationship with no reproach on them as a person. So that's number one, that we don't want to have this baggage that that person carries into the next relationship, and they need to say to their other girlfriend or boyfriend, oh, by the way, when I was in a relationship with them, this is the stuff we did. Not a good way to start another relationship. Second, physical contact is a very powerful way to communicate all kinds of feelings. So, you know, if a child is crying, we hug them. If a friend is grieving, we might hug them. If we're feeling good about winning a game, we might high-five each other or something like that. And sometimes we slap each other on the back if we want to congratulate somebody. So there's different ways that we communicate with physical contact. And I'm going to acknowledge that when we're learning to know someone with the intent to marry them, it probably seems unnatural not to touch them. I'm going to go ahead and say that it probably seems that way. But I'm also going to say to you young people that there is a skill of communicating without touch that is good to learn. If you can talk through the complex feelings and emotions of dating without physical contact, that's going to be a good skill to have in marriage. It's going to be a really good skill to have. And I think if we short-circuit that learning process with physical contact, then we might get confused when we get married and we discover that some problems can't be solved just by holding her hand. And you're going to have to learn how to talk through it either then or when you're dating. And it's probably better to lay that foundation when you're dating. So what if you do learn to talk through those complex things, those emotions and things that come up? Well, by the time you learn to talk through that, you should probably be getting married. So there's really no reason to get physically involved after that. Third thing, it seems like we need to emphasize that engagement is still not a covenant relationship. An engagement is a promise to go through with a covenant relationship. It's still not the public wedding ceremony, and engagement doesn't give us a license for breaking down standards either. And by that time, it should be only a short time until marriage. And so some people say, well, are you saying we can't even shake her hand? Well, let's think about that just a little bit. This is the question. What kind of physical touch contact is appropriate for a married man to a woman who is not his wife? Ask yourself that question, and then you will have your answer for what kind of physical contact is appropriate in dating. You see, the dating relationship, for some reason, we think that it clouds the issue, but when you start saying, would it be okay for me as a married man to do what you're doing with your girlfriend? When we start putting that into that context, instantly it's like, no, that's not okay. What's changed? So in our culture, I think a common greeting of a handshake is an appropriate contact between men and women, no matter what their marriage status is. That is appropriate. And so it seems to me that this is a simple and wise way to know how much touch is good or acceptable. Anyway, Probably could say more on that. Let's move on. Another principle in dating, remember to honor your authority. This idea of dating, sometimes dating couples get this idea that they are, it's, the world is all about them. And, you know, it's this glorious time of life where you're having all this romance and all this stuff. And it is, it's wonderful. But there's one false statement, and that is that it's not all about you. If indeed you do decide to get married, your marriage is going to affect the community you decide to live in. Your marriage is going to affect any children that you might have. Your marriage is going to affect the younger people that watch how you did things. You are not in a vacuum as a dating couple. The world is not revolving around you. And so I go back to this thing of honoring authority, and that is, you're still under your parents, you're still under spiritual leadership at church, you still have people watching you, especially young people that are highly interested in this whole process of a young man and a young lady dating. And so behaving as an honorable young couple under your authority, even as you're taking steps out into making your own home, is a huge mark of maturity. And it gives people a lot of confidence that you will do well. Sometimes people ask the question, how long should a couple date? And I say that all depends. Totally depends on how well you know the person before you started dating. It depends on how often you do have dates. It depends on how old you are, probably, because there is a lot of maturity that happens. And so it really just depends. If you honor all the other principles I talked about, you'll know how long you should date. Well, what if we need to break off a relationship? I just have a couple of things to say. There are times when a relationship doesn't work in the sense that it ends up where a couple gets married. And if you know that the person that you're spending time with is just not the one you want to spend the rest of your life with, if you find that out within a visit or two, be kind and just say, I don't think this is going to work. On the other hand, if you're a young lady and this young guy asks you out of the blue and you never considered it as a possibility, you might want to give him a little bit of time to actually see what kind of person he really is, because you didn't think about him at all. Chances are he's been thinking about you for quite a while, but you haven't given it any thought. And so you might need a little bit of time to know if this is really the man that you want to spend time with the rest of your life with. But never, ever, ever, ever marry someone just because you feel sorry for them. Never do that. Never marry somebody because you think you're in a unique position to help them overcome something in their life. Those are two things you should never do. Because it's not going to work. You might be able to limp along and make it half work. If you've done that, you can probably make it work. You have to make it work. It's the only option. But don't go into it planning for that. That would just be a disaster. Another reason that you might break off a friendship is if you discover that the person has consistent failure in his life or her life rather than consistent victory. We don't expect perfection in people, but we do expect Christian growth and victory. And of course, there's always the unfaithfulness, and we don't need to say any more about that. When it does come time to break off a relationship, I just have a few things to say about that. First of all, pray about it. Mind the golden rule. As you would that men should do to you, do ye to them likewise. Be honest about it, but don't be cruel about it. I know there's young men, sometimes we talk about this subject at Bible school, and they say things like, well, I would want the young lady to tell me why she's breaking up. Honestly, I doubt you mean that. It's a brave thing to say, but I, for one, as an 18, 19, 20-year-old young man, would not have wanted an 18, 19, 20-year-old young lady reading me my pedigree at all. There's other people in that man's life that can do that for him. I seriously doubt that a girl breaking the relationship off is the one to do that. It also could lead to confusion. If for some reason the young lady or the young man breaking off the relationship says these are the reasons, and especially if they're a little bit vague or whatever, the person might be thinking, well, if I can fix those things, would this work? If the answer is no, it's no. Just say no. It's not happening. It's not working. I'm not feeling like this is what God wants us to do. And so I think a kind and honest, it's over conversation is just the way to break it off. And then the follow-up to that is don't tell the whole world why you didn't like that person as a prospective marriage partner. Assassinating someone's character and reputation, no matter who they are, is not a Christian thing to do. And so we should just remember that we don't have to justify to the world why we decided to break that relationship off. Well, we already talked about engagement just a little bit. I think engagement periods should be short, should be long enough to prepare for a wedding, and that's about it. In conclusion, I would like to just say that I laid out a lot of ideals here. I know that maybe we've come to the conclusion that our marriage is just going to be a wreck because we didn't do all these things, and that's not true. There's always ways forward out of mistakes, things that maybe didn't go the best. There's always redemption. There's always repentance. There's always trust that can be built. There's all of those things that can happen. It doesn't mean that your marriage is an absolute failure just because maybe you failed in your courtship. But just because there is that doesn't mean that we should go and try to make it as bad as possible. It's a little bit like if you know to do good and you don't do it, then it becomes sinful. But if you didn't know or you made honest mistakes or whatever, it doesn't mean that your marriage is forever ruined. It doesn't mean that at all. But I think as a group of people trying to honor Jesus, we should reach for the goal, reach for the ideal. Because if we settle for anything less, then it will always be less. And we don't want that. So courtships are successful when they lead to people finding God's will, whether or not they end up getting married or not. Let's kneel for prayer.